Welcome to the Voice of Florida Architecture. I'm your host, Rhonda Hammond, AIA. One of AIA Florida's most impactful events, and our second largest, is our Legislative Day. Held in Tallahassee, AIA Florida hosts architects from around the state to gather and share the issues affecting the practice of architecture and the built environment with our legislators. This year, Legislative Day is scheduled for Tuesday, February 4th. You can register for the event on our website. We look forward to seeing everyone there. With us today is our new Vice President of Advocacy, Mr. Jeff Huber, FAIA. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I have to share, in preparing for our conversation, I became a little starstruck looking over your resume. I know now why I've heard so many different people at different times say, I want to be Jeff when I grow up. So you've navigated a brilliant career to date, and you have many, many, many years to continue to champion architecture and the issues that you're passionate about. So thank you for being here. You're currently a member of AIA Fort Lauderdale, and you've been a member of AIA Miami, your home being in South Florida. I shared recently with you that I think that you are the epitome or the true Renaissance man. You're a practicing architect, landscape architect, a firm principal, a professor, a published author, subject matter expert on designing for climate challenges and the challenges surrounding affordable housing. You're a fellow, and it's rumored that you are youngest from the state of Florida. You've been awarded the Citizen Architect from AIA Florida. At the national level, you were awarded the Young Architect Award, Firm of the Year in 2012, and the Gold Medal in 2022. Your firm has also won 4 top 10 code awards. And I have firsthand knowledge that 9 of the projects that you submitted for design awards last year was awarded from our esteemed Korean jury. You've made such an impact on the profession, but let's start with your journey to architecture. Tell us about your journey here.
Yeah, My journey to architecture wasn't very linear. I mean, it was shaped by personal experiences, family, and a bit of sibling rivalry. I have a twin brother, and we were always incredibly competitive growing up. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, but I can remember my grandparents always handing us papers and pencils. And, you know, we were always trying to design the better house, trying to design the better city, trying to design the better buildings. And it was kind of interesting from that perspective, but kind of ironic with him, because when we first went to college, originally he was on the path to architecture and I was starting out as engineering, but getting into the architecture career was actually shaped by Hurricane Andrew. That destroyed my family home in Homestead in 1992. It's one of those things that showed me that living through the kind of devastation and the long road of recovery exposed these kind of deep vulnerabilities and how we can rethink design in our communities. And so it wasn't just about rebuilding structures for me, but it was also about restoring the stability of families like mine. I was raised by a single mother struggling to make ends meet. I mean, these were all experiences that kind of drove me towards architecture. And as you've even mentioned, even later into landscape architecture, because I saw how interconnected our built in natural environments are and how I could have a role in shaping them far beyond my own lifetime and really touching a lot more than just my own personal interests, but really communities that I was living in and wanted to thrive in. And so today I carry those lessons with me on every project. I believe that architects do have the power to shape not just landscapes, but lives. Of course, there are these obstacles, political challenges, economic pressures, and sometimes even our own missteps. But I think the thoughtful, intentional design can create lasting effects in our communities. And that's kind of what drove me towards studying architecture. I originally came into University of Florida in 98, starting out as engineering, but quickly decided to move over to architecture, ultimately getting my undergrad and my master's degrees there at University of Florida. And it's been a really humbling kind of experience since then. I was always, as I say, exiled in Arkansas for about 10 years, where I got to work at the University of Arkansas Community Design Center. And that was another one of these kind of moments that really shaped my journey and kind of expanding that role of thinking about how does community design, urban design, architecture, landscape architecture all merge together.
Well, you've been such an integral part of AIA Florida. And you were part of the convention committee putting together the programming for last year's convention. But I'd like to start with your role as Vice President of Advocacy. The ongoing work for our advocacy committee is the least tangible benefit, but by far the most impactful on a day-to-day basis. What do you see as the purpose of the advocacy committee?
Well, the advocacy committee is where design and policy intersect. I mean, it's even politics, right? So it's our responsibility as architects to ensure that we have a strong voice in the policies that shape how we build for the future, especially in the state of Florida, but nationally and broadly in the communities that we are locally living in. But the advocacy committee at AI Florida really gives us that positioning at the state level. And Legislative Days does provide our opportunity to directly engage lawmakers and advocate for policies that support resilient design, affordable housing, and sustainability, resiliency, all of these aspects that we really find critical to us as architects in the state of Florida and what we're addressing and the challenges that we're facing. I really do see that our other purpose of the advocacy committee is to encourage architects to think more proactively, embracing what I really like to touch on is supply side thinking, very different than the kind of demand side. And to be supply side means to create innovative solutions that address societal needs rather than waiting on demand to dictate actions. This is our way in which we can be proactive. One of the things that I'm really interested in this year is really taking on things like what Kim Dowdell pushed last year as our AIA national president, and looking at ways that we can advance the idea of embedding the chief architect or the city architect roles back into municipalities, counties, and other policy level planning organizations. This is where our thought leadership and design, I think, can really help to address wicked problems, challenges that we have in our built environments, but also what cities are facing, again, to become more resilient, sustainable, and equitable. We can look at it through how design thinking can really solve for these pressing issues. And I do think design is missing at these larger scales of community design and planning. And so for me, I think our advocacy committee has been doing great things. It's doing and will continue to do great things. But this legislative day is so critically important for us because, again, it's where design and policy intersect and where we can have the greatest impacts beyond our own profession, our own practices, and our own careers.
You recently published Salty Urbanism, a design manual to address sea level rise and climate change for urban areas in the coastal zones, and have very quickly become the subject matter expert on climatic issues here in Florida. So tell us, what is salty urbanism?
I'm still trying to figure that out. Salty urbanism, I mean, ultimately, it's been a project over the last decade, and it really galvanized around a design manual that I've dealt with and developed with so many different team members. I mean, this is not one individual. It is a consortium of individuals, both through my academic, professional, as well as friendships, quite frankly. But it's a design manual focused on coastal cities and how we can adapt to future sea level rise and climate change. But I think it has relevance for any community that's really dealing with issues around flooding. So these can be inland communities, but it did have that kind of bent towards salty sides of things. And that's why, you know, hence the salty urbanism. It's a coastal adaptation manual. But it was developed through research at FAU in partnership with the city of Fort Lauderdale, as well as Broward County, as well as my own firm, Brooke Scarpa. And so the concept was simple yet powerful. Future development must become flood adaptive asset rather than an environmental liability. How do we kind of work around that? So the work embodies, again, the supply side of thinking, designing for proactive long-term solutions instead of waiting for a crisis to force change. So salty urbanism offers practical strategies for integrating green infrastructure and natural systems into cities, blending resilience with community-centered design focuses. It's about creating spaces that protect people while enriching daily lives, but it's also pretty impactful. I mean, about 20 years ago, I read the book Win-Win Ecology by Michael Rosenzweig, and he always said, do humans and the natural world really have to be in opposition to one another? And so that was always a kind of interesting question to me, is like, how can we think about landscapes, natural systems, work in tandem with architecture, urban design, and other things to derive solutions that are not just about creating urban services or community services in our communities, but also ecosystem services. And that's a kind of strange kind of way of thinking, because what it forces us to do is landscape can no longer be thought about as ornamentation or decoration in our built environment, but yet has to really become infrastructural. And so if you can start to tie, again, architecture and landscape architecture together, you start to provide these ecosystem services. And those ecosystem services are related to four major things: flooding, food production, habitat and refuge, temperature regulation. And so as I was looking through all this, I mean, these are all issues that I find really compelling because they're the challenges of our time. And so salty urbanism's geared around flooding, but I'm already working on like the next set of books, which is shady urbanism, which is going to deal with heat resilience. So it's part of that ecosystem service. And then I'm also looking at seedy urbanism about rewilding and these kind of ideas. I mean, even the challenges today that we're looking at in Los Angeles and the wildfires, thinking about how do we always become thought leaders. And so salty urbanism was really ultimately for me to figure out the challenge of how do we begin to solve for one of the greatest issues that Florida and more specifically South Florida will face over the next 100 years more than anything else. And that's the sea level rise and these issues around flooding.
So were you aware that you informed the poster in our 2018 legislative session about the five forms of flooding?
I wasn't aware of that, but you know, I do want to say that it wasn't just me. There was several entities, and I know we had our inaugural strategic council at our own AIA Florida state level. And so John Englander, Ronaldo Borges, you know, folks like that, as well as Don Yoshino and Andy Hayes. I mean, all of these guys all, you know, we were really trying to find ways in which we could communicate the challenge and communicate the issues, especially within the climate, the political climate that we were in at the time. And so it was always funny that the five forms of flooding, you know, just kind of became a natural way to communicate it. But John Englander, I think I have to give him the credit for that, because that's the way he really positioned it. And it was interesting because Eskimos have 100 words for snow. We really needed to expand our way in which we talked about flooding, not just rainfall, but it's also runoff. Then you have coastal flooding from storm surge, tidal flooding, but also the groundwater table and the kind of, you know, challenges around annual kind of cycling around that. I always loved South Florida because we don't have four seasons like most of the rest of the country. We have two seasons, wet and dry. And so, you know, those were kind of fun moments, but it was incredible to be a part of the that process and really communicating those issues back in 2018.
So in your book, you have a case study about North Beach Village. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, North Beach Village, you know, what was interesting is the city of Fort Lauderdale, when salty urbanism first came about, and this was again back in 2014, when I first moved back from my exile in Arkansas. 2014, the city came and they had just, the state of Florida had just approved these adaptation action areas, and they called North Beach Village and Fort Lauderdale Beach one of these. And, you know, I went ahead and presented to the city on this book that I had done called Low Impact Development, a Design Manual for Urban Areas, which is really an ecological stormwater management infrastructure that prefaces plants over pipes in a nutshell. And I presented this and they thought this was a great way that we could look at how we could design the streetscapes, the public realm in North Beach Village. And so we went there, and North Beach Village was fascinating to me because one, it was like 90% impervious. I mean, you could fly and land a 747 jet on some of these streets. They were so wide and over-designed. And so one of the things that we got excited by was also the fact that it was mid-century modernism there. I mean, it had some of the largest stock of mid-century modernism. It had these really challenging issues of large amounts of impervious surface. And so we wrote a National Endowment for the Arts, Our Town grant called Botanizing the Asphalt of North Beach Village, Integrating Resilient Design and Public Art. And that we won. And so we were able to work with the city of Fort Lauderdale through a streetscape design that was really the precursor to the Salty Urbanism Project, which then later on kind of addressed and expanded into the public, or from the public realm into the private realm. And so that was quite an interesting step. But, you know, North Beach Village, being on the barrier island here in South Florida, also had this kind of great incubator, this great laboratory of exploring these ideas, because it had some of the highest ground in all of Fort Lauderdale, and then also some of the lowest ground. We went from 1 foot above sea level all the way to about 15 feet above sea level. And so it really allowed for us to kind of explore these notions of different types of flooding, the five forms of flooding we were just talking about, and coming up with strategies and a toolbox and a toolkit for how to explore this from the scale of the neighborhood down to the scale of buildings.
What is it that you would like for communities or practitioners or building officials, city leaders? What would you like for them to take from this body of work? How do you think that it can help?
Well, first things first, probably just beyond the book, but think trees. Planting lots of trees are going to be one of our biggest abilities to absorb and deal with some of the deleterious kind of effects and challenges we're going to have in the future, both through heat and flooding. Trees have the amazing capacity to be biopumps. The fact that we're burning fossil fuels, running pumps in communities like Miami Beach just to get rid of some of the flooding really just kind of creates and perpetuates the challenge. Because if we got into this issue of sea level rise and climate change because of burning fossil fuels, it's kind of ironic that we're going to burn fossil fuels to also remove those challenges. So, you know, for me, again, looking at the natural kind of ecosystem services that could come from that is one thing. And so challenging municipal leaders and staff to think that landscape becomes infrastructure, having them think about a tree in the same way they think about a pipe is a very cognitive and kind of abstract leap. And so that's one of the biggest things I would like to kind of leave on the minds of most of those leaders is how does landscape become infrastructure in our communities? How do we begin to leverage it to work for us and benefit the investments and the tax base and the taxpayers' money that we're spending in these communities? And there's other things, obviously, I want them to think about, but I think the codes need to change. I think regulations, I think we need to think through some really complex things. I mean, it's a huge challenge when we see events like Surfside and the Champlain South Tower collapse that killed 98 people a few years ago. That was, I think, a wake-up call in our built environment to address the fact that we can build the most resilient building to sustain and survive the impacts of these natural disasters. But when we have these compounded effects of multiple disasters upon multiple disasters, seeing future sea level rise, saltwater intrusion, corrosion and erosion in our built environment, and that over a lengthy period of time and how that's creating challenges, I think we need to find other solutions and working with municipal and state leadership even to find and resolve issues. For instance, FEMA's floodplain regulations are great, but they don't take sea level rise into account. I can also design a building to FEMA standards, but they don't take into account the materials that I'm putting in there in that long-term exposure, which again, going back to Surfside, that was some of the challenges. I mean, were you still using steel reinforcement and rebar in our buildings? I mean, these are, I think, things where architects will need to become, again, thought leaders on talking through these challenges with our building officials, with our elected officials, with our state representatives and legislature to really leverage what architects can bring to the table, and the knowledge that we have can be utilized to really, you know, think about Florida 2.0, or how we make a wetter Florida a better Florida, or how we make a hotter Florida more resilient. Because there's just tons of these challenges that we keep seeing through the natural disasters, but, you know, also in between how we kind of manage the aftermaths of these, as well as the time between natural disasters.
Have you had any city officials or local officials anywhere reach out to you to start the conversation?
You know, ironically, no. There's been challenges like, you know, we've sat down with building officials and talked to them about how much sea level rise they're planning for. And in most cases, they'll say 1 to 3 feet of sea level rise. And I've always thought that was interesting because we talk to a lot of building officials and especially engineers in cities. And if we're designing infrastructure to last 50 years, we really need to be thinking 50 years out and even beyond that, because in most communities and most municipalities and most jurisdictions, it takes 10 years just to get from funding to concept to design to engineering to construction documents. And then if a building or a piece of infrastructure is intended to last another 50 years, that means like we're talking 60 years out. And so effectively, we need to be looking at those unified projections for future sea level rise or other climate change issues related to that, and know where we're going to be in the future. And so I have been able to talk with a lot of committees, whether those be board committees or resiliency committees or subcommittees across this region and across the world, quite frankly, and even AIA organizations globally that are looking for how do we embed ourselves, or how do we get the building officials or the planning officials to listen to some of these and heed some of these warnings? And the answer is, quite frankly, it's they have so many issues they're already dealing with, and they understand the importance of getting and addressing these and solving these issues. But the challenge is again, there's so many problems that they have to address day to day that it's very hard to have that next step up thinking about this. And that's where we see the chief resiliency officers of our communities, you know, even Miami-Dade County having a chief heat officer. I mean, these are folks that are at least there to think about the future, proofing our communities beyond the day to day. You know, we can look at it even from our own way in which AIA National structured, with the board working through day-to-day activities, working through budgetary issues, and the strategic council working on larger issues that are going to affect the profession in 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now. So I think that's where my conversations with the municipalities and these other committees have been, is that we can't project the next 3 to 5 years by looking at the past 3 to 5 years. We have to think beyond that and start to say and question, when I'm putting this dollar into the ground, which is taxpayer dollars, is this the best way in which I can spend the public's money? And if we can't answer that with a concrete and smart, rational decision based on what we see the science telling us today, then, you know, we're wasting that money. So those are some of the conversations. And hopefully, you know, folks are listening, but, you know, these challenges in the day to day are just so extreme right now that it's really hard to think about that next 10, 15, 20, 30 years.
As I mentioned earlier, you're an educator, an associate professor, and in 2022, you were awarded the AIA Florida McMinn Award, which is the Educator of the Year. This allows you a unique perspective on the transition between education and practice. In 2023, the theme for our convention was Liminal Spaces Bridging the Gap. With ever-evolving tools to conceptualize, design, and deliver projects, our 2023 president, Beverly Frank, AIA, wanted to focus on the gap to discover opportunities for the profession and academia to collaborate. From your perspective, how do you see practitioners and academia collaborating, and what does that relationship look like, or what should it focus on?
Well, there's immense value in bridging the gap between academia and practice. I mean, one of the reasons I teach is because I love the fact that I can go into the classroom, I can encourage students to confront wicked problems and the kind of complex challenges we've been talking about, like climate change, housing inequality, you know, and I can get them to think with bold and imaginative, innovative ways to approach this in design. And then the flip side, in practice, I mean, these are hard challenges to try to face and get into. And so we need to test those ideas in the real world. And we have real world constraints. We have normative practice constraints that really sometimes stymie or hinder us or can create the issue. I mean, Larry, my partner, Larry and Angie both always kind of say this. Sometimes it's the intestinal fortitude to just outwit, outlast, and outplay sometimes in our practice that separates us from other practices. But the academy, this is what I like about it, is because we can explore things. It's an agnostic kind of organization. It has no real skin in the game from the sense of other than wanting to do the right thing and looking at best practices or developing new through research, innovative design research, or models, frameworks for how we think about these challenges of our time. But the flip side of that is, again, the practice and having these real world, these practice normative kind of constraints really do create challenges for architects. And so I like that kind of dichotomy between theory to practice, between innovation to practicality. This is something that I think we need to do better at kind of as Beverly Frank was saying, is bridging that kind of gap. And you know, one of the ways we always did it when I was working at the Community Design Center and at the University of Arkansas was I thought of that, and we always talked about it as a kind of teaching hospital model. Just like the medical profession has the teaching hospital, we should have more of these kind of teaching hospital models and architecture where we link the academy and professional practice in these community design centers that allow for students, educators, and professionals all work in a collaborative way to solve for some of these greater challenges that don't look like they are competing with each other. Because that's one of the things I want to also say is that academia should not compete with professional practice. But yet we can find challenges like the ones we're talking about, these wicked problems that there is no clear set answer for because they're not tame problems like 1 + 1 = 2. These wicked problems really around climate change or around social equity, they need new ways of thinking. They need new frameworks. And that's why I think this idea to have a collaborative space, and there are these. We do see community design centers at University of Miami. We see them at University of Florida. We see them at other institutions, but we also see the design build studio. I think that's a great model for how we're beginning to bridge and have practitioners and academia collaborate more effectively. We also see internships or externships, as they're even called. Right now, we currently have an extern from the University of Tennessee from Knoxville working in our office for 2 weeks before she starts school again. And this just gives them exposure and opportunities to bridge that gap between why they're students to when they become young professionals. We also can see research partnerships. I think more and more we need to see architectural firms collaborate and actually invest in the academic institutions around them to really create an R&D or research and development partnership that can be a feedback. And this is where theoretical innovation and practical application can inform each other and kind of go back and forth. So that approach fosters, you know, proactive supply side thinking, as I've mentioned before, where design solutions can, you know, again, address these problems before they escalate within our built environment or within our professions themselves. But I think we need to learn how to better respect both too. As an academic and a practitioner, I can see both sides. There's a little bit of a lack of respect that I think we need to find what is the value set of each one, what they bring to the table, because where academia may lack practical experience, it does push the boundaries of new technology, research, and other things that also feed back into practice, and vice versa. Practice, again, sees codes, sees zoning, sees these real-world normative practice constraints that encourage or press us. And so that dialogue between the two sometimes is mismatched because we don't quite know how to bridge what we did as students or what we did as academics in the academy and bridging that over into the real world application and getting buildings built. And not just buildings. I like Dan Hart's message of always beyond buildings and thinking about that. So I think those are the things that we need to explore and really engage in. And so it's technology, it's innovation, it's material science, it's the material culture. Some of those things that I think academia can really help bridge over into the practice side, and vice versa. Practice can really help engage what are those normative practice constraints that we really need to understand and solve for, and how do we get beautiful architecture as well as resilient and equitable architecture and urban design and community design from that.
So you've been an educator during the rise of technology and AI and VR and AR. How do you see that changing the education?
Yeah, I was always an opponent of technology. I mean, you know, it's funny how this stuff cycles. I never thought I'd be my parents, but I've become my parents. I never thought I'd become my professors, but now I've become my professors. Where, you know, this idea of the haptic versus computer. I mean, when we were talking 30 years ago as the computer was coming out, there was a real fight towards holding on to the haptic or the analog side of things, drawing by hand. And then there was this kind of flip side of accepting. I think we're now at a phase, if we don't look at AI and these kind of emerging technologies, artificial intelligence and emerging technologies that are coming out now, we could present potentially as a profession be lost. I don't think fully, but I think it has the potential to have some real ramifications on our practices. And I say that because as we're looking at AI and we're looking at these, and again, it's not to say that hand drawing or anything like that is against it. I mean, I still love to sketch by hand. I mean, I can show you that's how we start, but we start through concepts, hand sketching, and then it moves quickly into the computer. And the computer is an essential tool for us now. I think AI is going to become an essential tool, even digital fabrication techniques. I mean, these are ways in which we're finding how to do things more efficient. We're finding how to do things more economically, more equitably. Two, I don't see the technologies as, even though I was that kind of a point, I become a proponent because of studying it over the last 3 years on Strategic Council, and I know we'll probably dive into some of that. But I see AI as really expanding my own practice, or these technologies expanding the practice from the very onset through pre-design all the way to the backside through construction administration and even operations and maintenance. When you see on the first front side in pre-design, when you're starting to look at upcodes or you're starting to look at some of these other new technologies that are available to us to really press forward and quickly get to an understanding of what we need to know for the projects that we're getting into for upcodes for those challenges. It's just like I can tell it, here's my construction type, here's the place it's in, and here's the, so it just allows me to understand the codes, the other limitations, assemblies, all these things that will really tie back to life safety concerns or constructability concerns. Like I can start to understand that. But then on the backside, through construction administration and operations and maintenance, I mean, looking at the digital twins and how those are starting to really radically change the profession, but also our own clients. And I think we need to understand as architects, how do we leverage that as our own assets? And leveraging it as our own ability to be revenue generating in a whole new way for our practices. I think those are the things to me that I see technology going to help and advance us. And so I know I can answer more, but I'll end it there for now.
Well, it sounds like it can be effective in making us more efficient and more informed as opposed to taking over someone's job. I think there's fear when people don't understand.
Well, and that's why I really say and couch it in the sense that we need to be actively engaged. Because if we're, the old adage goes, if you're not seated at the table, you're on the menu. So we need to be better at getting ourselves inculcated, integrated into the technologists, the technology field, the people writing these programs, and making sure that we as architects are at the table. So we have an influence. We also have the ability to guide those conversations, the development of these tools to better serve our needs and the needs of the public. After all, at the end of the day, I mean, architects' role is the protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the public. And if we can't define that, or we can develop a tool that can do that for us, that is a huge challenge, but also a potential opportunity. We had last year at the convention, we had Phil Bernstein, who talked about that. One of the things that we had Phil come in and speak to the Strategic Council was exactly about how were these tools going to change and how do we become more efficient. But he said something quite provocative. Until we as architects redefine health, safety, and welfare, we could potentially be in a challenging issue. But we need to understand that tools like artificial intelligence, they cannot answer wicked problems. They cannot answer issues of climate change or social equity issues. Only we as architects can really do that because the challenges are so interconnected with so many different things that AI as a tool can really only think about augmentation and automation at the level of one thing at a time, at least right now. And so, I really feel like if we can leverage that and be responsible in expanding our practices to accept these new technologies and tools, we can, again, be at the table and be responsible to our public, but also to our profession.
So speaking of being at the table, in 2024, you completed your term as one of the Florida representatives on the Strategic Council, the National Council. So tell us about the purpose of the council and what your role was while you were there.
Yeah, so the purpose of the council, back in 2015, I believe it was, is where we split this this large board and kind of broke into the council and the board and separated those two. And that was very clear, as I've already indicated. The board's mission and role is really fiduciary. It's dealing with day-to-day activities, the finance, the budgets, and kind of the cadence of the year's activities at National, or the Strategic Council. Interestingly enough, it's this thought leadership arm about future-proofing the profession and thinking about what is going to impact our profession most over the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 years. And so for me, that was an interesting kind of aspect that our strategic council was engaging in as I was on it for the last 3 years, about 5 different study areas. And those study areas were exactly these things that we felt were going to be most profoundly impacting the profession. This past year, that happened to be resilience issues, our climate-related issues around water. There's issues around equity, issues around artificial intelligence and the impact of emerging technologies, role of architects and architecture. And these were really important, I think, issues to ask the question. But I think this year in 2025, it was even more interesting as the going out on the council in 2024, we had some part in setting that new stage. It used to be we always, at the beginning of the year, had the big think. That was somewhat removed to start the big think kind of more the year before. So we could be more projective, more strategic in outlining what the Strategic Council should be working on over that year, because we wanted to get the membership out this information much quicker. And so right now, even the 2024 study groups, we've presented that information to the board. The board does have the reports, and those reports will be available to the public pretty soon. So every year, the Strategic Council has these reports. What's interesting now is we're in 2025, right? And I said that this restructuring happened in 2015. So one of the interesting aspects of the council this year is to really look back at the last 10 years. And what has the council kind of done? How does it, what is its 2.0? What does the next 10 years of the council look like? And so, you know, we're even developing a Bethune Fellows Council, which, if you're not familiar, if you're on the council and you serve for your full service time, you become a Bethune Fellow, which is quite a special moment where you're bestowed this kind of medal and at the end of the year. But that Bethune Council now has this kind of ability to really help and carry the Strategic Council even forward, moving forward and being a resource for them. And, you know, what we're looking at is not repeating ourselves. How do we better build bridges, like we were just talking about, between the academy and the profession? We're talking about how to better build a bridge between the board and our membership, even through the council. And so that, like, to me, the council was one of the most important, I think, bodies in the national organization, because it does become this kind of segue, or this bridge, with so many different networked activities that are happening across the AIA, whether they, again, be the board, or they be the knowledge, the 21 knowledge communities, or they be the general membership or the state, the local levels. So that's the National Strategic Council's mission, is to really interconnect, be a resource, be thought leadership, pushing forward strategic thinking for our organization as well as our profession, that allows us to refocus around issues that are going to be relevant and impactful in our profession. This year, this last year, got to work through development of an AI resolution, an artificial intelligence resolution, and talking about how we can, you know, be a seat at the table, I was just referring to. And so, you know, I learned from Bill Hercules last year, who worked through the well-being AI, or the well-being resolution. And so now we're trying to do this with AI and talking about technology and how we need to kind of bolster that. So those are the issues in which the Strategic Council engages and works through. As a counselor, you're also other committee roles at the national level. And so it's really a tremendous asset. I'm hoping that our members, all over the last 3 years, I think Bill Hercules and I, you know, our biggest challenge was to be able to get the information of what the council was doing out to our members. And so that first year, I know Bill was pushing to get a monthly report out. And so we've been getting those monthly reports out and making those available through the Friday Facts and other missions. So you can see, as members, what we were working on, what we're engaging in. And I think now we have a great ability, with Stephen Panzerino serving as the current representative now for 2025. 2025 through 2027. But we also have two at-large members. You know, we have Gloria Coulter, as you know, as well as Ignacio Reyes, who are serving as at-large members. So we have a great amount of representation from AI Florida on the National Strategic Council right now. I think we're going to see our voices heard and how National can help serve, and hopefully a lot more reciprocation between AI Florida and AI National.
So switching to the affordable housing issue, which is multifaceted, and I believe there's a role architects can play. It was a focus, one of the focus at my convention back in July of 24. You served on the panel that took a look at the issue from different lenses, from with city officials, architects, planners, and we had builders. And your firm has successfully addressed this issue in a variety of solutions and in different locations. First, what exactly is the affordable housing crisis?
It's a challenge.
I know it's big. It's like there's question. There's so much.
Right. Well, let's just put it in this perspective. The affordable housing crisis is staggering. This is the biggest housing crisis we've ever seen in the history of the United States, and quite frankly, globally, but the United States has ever seen. I mean, we've never had the challenges that we're seeing today. We are currently facing a 7 million housing unit gap nationwide. The issue is even more urgent when you recognize the fact that just in this past year, 34% increase in homeless families with children. Just in this past year, we have challenges where our own graduates coming out of the schools of architecture in the state of Florida are part of this crisis. The fact is they aren't making the salaries that are commensurate with the amounts it costs us to spend from our salaries on housing. It used to be our housing, we spent upwards of about 30%, whether that be through rent and mortgages. And keep in mind that 30% also included everything that goes into that, insurance, our utility bills, everything that housing was up to 30%. And we're now seeing people that are spending upwards of 50% to 70% of their salaries and income on housing. It is astronomically staggering right now, the challenges and the issues that we're seeing people facing across the state with housing and across this country. And so as architects, we have to ask ourselves, what can we do in the affordable housing crisis? And I don't like to say affordable housing because, quite frankly, it's got a stigma. I like to say that, you know, housing is a right. It just like we have a right to basic needs of fresh air, clean water, clothes, food, shelter is an essential aspect that everybody has a right to in the United States and in the state of Florida. I mean, if we don't think about it from that standpoint, there's already a mistake. And so that's why for me, it's a much broader issue than we as architects, but we as architects can kind of define, look through the issue. Attainable housing is what I always like to call it, or just housing. You know, we can just be fair. Like, we just need to make housing more accessible and more attainable for everyone and at every level. And so, you know, that challenge is where architects can really look at how do we design, think through affordable housing? How do we look at the systemic and regulatory landscape of housing? Understanding that even within affordable housing that we work on, 70% of the design of affordable housing is done before, you know, we're even hired on as the architect. It's completed before, you know, we even get engaged. And so we're dealing with a lot of challenges that in some cases can increase the costs of the housing projects we work on by 34% just because of the way they're financed. The financing and the regulations that are forced on some of these projects do drive up the costs, yet the architect is the one that's blamed for the cost escalations in a lot of cases. I'll take some credit, but I'm not going to take 100% of the credit. I'll take, you know, 10, 15, 20% of the credit. And that's where we just need to do better at being value engineering our projects from the get-go, but we also need to ensure that well-designed affordable housing looks great day one, as well as day our year 30. And that's why we need to look at them as functional, beautiful. We need to start asking the questions around missing middle. Missing middle housing types are those that fill this kind of gap and this need within our own zoning. And so we need to look at zoning reforms, and we need to look at community support to make things more viable, to expand the purview or to expand the products that we're placing out there. Unfortunately, it's a no one size fits all solution, but architects can lead to designing adaptable housing models. We can advocate for inclusive policies. We can collaborate with housing advocates. In my own upbringing and from my own personal experience, I mean, these have been really, you know, big challenges of how do we design better housing, you know, that has access to daylight, has access to fresh air, you know, being able to open up windows. I mean, these are all critical, you know, components to the design, but all these other things about policies, advocates advocating on it are all ways in which we can create stable housing. And I believe it's our responsibility as architects to design both the dignity and the resiliency of housing and keeping these things in mind. But this missing middle is a real huge challenge. And this is going back to what we were talking about in the advocacy committee. And one of the things that I'd like to look at this year is affordable housing. And how do we better think about this broader system of housing? And it may not be just where architects can have solutions, but yeah, we should just be thought leaders on what may be the more responsible or right way or policy changes that need to happen or enable, you know, things to happen to allow for us to be that resource for the communities, to be the resource for the public that we have. Collaborations will be essential.
So Jeff, you have been a champion for the association on many, many levels. And you know, we've just scratched the surface here with this conversation. Tell us why you got involved with AIA and why you think AIA is important. You have such a direct line from the work that you do, and you've obviously been successful and are passionate about it, but such a direct line from the experience of their youth to what you do now. So it's, you talked about Hurricane Andrew, and that is totally the epitome of the climate crisis, and then the affordable housing. When you first look at it, they don't seem to be connected as they are. And I just find it an interesting story.
It is interesting. You know, one of the things that I learned quickly, this is the good Catholic in me, you know, my biblical adage of iron sharpens iron as it goes. You know, all of these were personal kind of experiences I talked about that really influenced me onto my path into architecture. But architecture is a team sport. It's not an individual sport. And so, you know, all the successes that I've had are not my successes alone. I mean, I have been on the shoulders of giants. You know, both Larry and Angie have been great mentors to me, but there's so many other folks that have been mentors to me, from my professors in college, to my parents, to my brothers, to my wife, to my own kids. You know, all of these folks have created a network that I think, you know, makes us better people and gives us that ability. So I got involved in AI because I believe architects have a collective power to drive meaningful change when we work together. And AI provides a platform to advocate for the policies that support resilience, equity, sustainability, all the things that I'm talking about, that I'm passionate about. It gives me the ability to learn, to educate, to strengthen, and to leverage others in that same pursuit. So it offers that space for collaboration where we can learn from one another and push each other forward in the profession, but also into the publics that we serve. And that, to me, is critical for what the AIA can do. And so through AIA, I've had the opportunity to expand my role in individual projects to advocacy and leadership, you know, helping shape the systems that influence how we design and build. So for me, again, it goes back to this is not an individual sport. It's a team sport, and AIA really provides, you know, again, that ability to exponentially raise what I see as my impact on the profession and what it could be, but also, you know, what I see from others that I work with constantly at the AIA that to me are inspiring, that are people I want to be when I grow up. And, you know, I can name those people, but I would just say AIA Florida has been a great resource. And, you know, one of the things that when I was moving back to the state, you know, I went into, it was the AIA was national conference was having it in Chicago at the time. And, you know, I went in there with Martin Gold, who teaches at University of Florida, as well as, somebody that I was working with at the time, that was the director of the University of Arkansas Community Design Center, Stephen Luoni. And we went there, and I forced myself to go. And I was like, look, I'm going to move back to the state. I wanted to kind of see how AI Florida operate, because I wasn't sure if I wanted to be an AI member. Let's just, because AI or Arkansas, the University of Arkansas was paying my AI membership, but I wasn't leveraging it to the best I could in that organization. But I was really thoughtful and direct in making this leap to go to AI Florida's reception at the national convention that year. And it happened to be Nathan Butler was the AI Florida president current, but Andy Hayes was coming in as the new president. And Martin Gold introduced me to several, and to Nathan. Nathan introduced me to Andy. And then I thought it was interesting because, I was standing around after I talked with Andy, and there was this gentleman that walked over to me and said, "Who are you?" And it was Don Yoshino, and just got to get to know me. And, that was where I connected with Don. And, I think those relationships I still have to today, and Don being my sponsor when I went to fellowship was a kind of no-brainer for me. I wanted to be somebody that was a part of my transition when I went from Arkansas back to Florida through the AIA Florida. And I couldn't have thought of anybody, more impactful on, hey, this is somebody I want. These were all folks that, were great mentors. And, everybody I've met at AIA Florida has been great mentors, including you, Rhonda, and Becky and Chrissy, everybody that we see. These are all people that I think do positive things for our profession and for our careers. And I think it's about how do I give back? And that's what I think being involved in AIA has been so important to me, especially over the last 10 years.
Thank you, Jeff. Your dedication to our profession. From all of us that practice, from the members of AI Florida, I hope you know that you're loved and respected around the state. And I want to thank you for the students that you teach. They're the future architects, they're our future leaders. So I know that you're an incredible role model, inspiration to them as well. So thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you.
I hope our listeners have enjoyed the conversation with Jeff and that his dedication has inspired others to join in the conversation on designing for climate and for the affordable housing issue. Don't forget to register for Legislative Day scheduled for February 4th. You can do that at the AIA Florida website. I welcome you to subscribe to our podcast so you won't miss any of the upcoming episodes. This is Rhonda Hammond, AIA, your host. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Voice of Florida Architecture.